show you all something, and maybe you've seen, some of you have seen this before, I don't know, but maybe nobody has. I'd like to ask you, what do you see? You know, what is it? A piece, aside from a piece of plastic, you know. It really isn't anything that you could really, well, it's kind of a weird thing with colored rags on it. And so then if I turn it this way, then you see something, right?
Yeah.
You see a temple. Yeah. And this isn't any, like, this isn't a magic trick. You know, I didn't do anything. I just turned it. I just changed the perspective. And this happens again and again to us. Maybe we don't notice it very often, but again and again, we have one way of looking at something or understanding it. And then if we change our perspective, we have one this way maybe, and then we don't get it, that we're confused, you know, maybe even a little scared. And then we change our perspective, and then it all falls in place. It's really incredible. And this has happened to me a number of times, and probably it's happened to you also. So today, the subject is love. No, that's a title of a poem from Hafiz. Today the subject is death.
Love and death.
Yeah, they somehow go together. Once again, I'd like to, you know, like, keep things on the upside. And I want to give you all just a little piece of paper. This has to do with Tibetan Buddhism. And in Tibetan Buddhism, which is a very vast thing, and I'm certainly not a student of Tibetan Buddhism, it's way too much for me. But I do read books, and I do try and see Rinpoche's when I get the chance. But in Tibetan Buddhism, they talk about a rainbow body. And I have here two rainbow bodies. They're pretty much the same. One's a little bit darker than the other. And the Tibetans say that when a profound spiritual teacher dies, occasionally, you know, as they, you know, exit this world, their body turns into light, turns into a rainbow. And this has been documented and written about, and paintings have been done of it and everything. And I was very taken with this because we're all familiar with this, you know. Here is a light, a clear white light, which is sometimes a metaphor for God, going through a prism, and out the other side comes a rainbow, you know. And you could say that's us, you know. The pure white light has come through a mother and a father, and out came we. And we're different colors and different varieties. It seems like a pretty good metaphor. As a matter of fact, I even have one of these, which is actually a, what's this called? In there?
Prism.
It's not a crystal. A prism. Yeah, a prism. I have a prism in here. If we had a light source strong enough, we could probably actually see it, but they painted it in there, so you can see what it does. I came across these that I want to give to each of you. This is a rainbow body with a blank in the middle. So you can do with this blank in the middle as you please. You know, you can paste a picture of yourself in there, or a picture of your kids, or a picture of your wife, if you have a wife, you know. And if you want more, you can take more. You know, you don't have to just limit yourself to one. If you have some others that would enjoy this, you can take some more. But anyway, this is, you know, it seems to me like we all have the potential, actually it's going to happen sooner or later anyway, of turning back into light. And who knows, we might go through a rainbow in that process. So I'm going to pass this around. And like I say, take as many as you like. I've got more here too. Now, I would like to criticize our society just a little bit, before I go much further. Maybe I won't after all. Oh, yes, here we go. Okay. I found a book, as you can see, I'm sort of a book person. I'm not much of a computer person. I found a book recently. It just stunned me. It was just absolutely, wow. The title is The Complete Guide to Life After Graduation. Okay. And I was born in the late 30s, so I'm a pretty old guy. And all my you know, so-called adult life, I've been looking for a book like this. You know, I mean, I graduated a long time ago, but, you know, I'm still looking for, you know, what to do after graduation. And so I thought, man, this is the book, you know. And on the back here it says, what will you do the day after you walk across the stage for your diploma? Whether you are graduated from high school, technical school, or college, or have just earned your doctorate, this book contains the best advice you'll ever receive from any source. And I thought, I gotta have it. And so I bought it. And this is so good, I'm gonna share it with you right now. You know? I mean, the book is such that we can go through it very quickly. Okay? So we're gonna start with page one. We go to page two. We go to page three. We go to page four. We go to page 10. We go to page 20. We go to page 30. We go to page 40. We go to page 50. We go to the end of the book, and oh yeah, here's a little computer mark down here on the. I'm not sure what this means. So it's blank. The whole book is blank. And I thought, that's it. That's it. That's what our society is all about. You know, no preparation. No preparation, no significant preparation, particularly in the area of male creatures like myself. You know, I was totally unprepared to become a man. When I turned 18, I realized I wasn't a man, although I was strong enough and active enough and so forth. But I realized I wasn't a man. And so I thought, Greg, you've got to become a man. And so what I did is practically the day of my 18th birthday, I scraped together enough money to get a one-way ticket to San Diego on the Greyhound bus. At that time, I was living in Washington State. And went to San Diego and enlisted for 4 years in the Marines with the intention of becoming a man, because doesn't the Marines make men? You know, that's what they advertise. The first day I was in boot camp, I found out they didn't make men, they made killers. I thought, hey, I didn't join to be a killer, I joined to be a man. But I was stuck for 4 years. But I was really lucked out, because that was 4 years. We weren't fighting any wars. That was after Korea and before Vietnam. And so I lucked out, really. But I learned that the Marines don't make men, and I didn't find out what makes a man. I didn't even get close to it. And then in the last little while, in the last 10 years or so, an interesting development has come about. And this book represents that, and the cover of this book pretty much says it all. You know, it says, From Boys to Men, Spiritual Rites of Passage in an Indulgent Age. Spiritual Rites of Passage in an Indulgent Age. Here at the top, we have a bunch of teenagers, you know, people like us when we were teenagers, sitting around with their skateboards, bored, nothing to do, you know, and so forth. And here we have, in some Aboriginal tribe, I don't know, probably in the South Sea Islands, I'm not sure. But anyway, the boys are getting their faces painted and so forth, getting ready for initiation, or getting ready for the rite of passage. All Native peoples have had a rite of passage institutionalized in their society, and we haven't. We don't have an institutionalized rite of passage for our boys. Some of the Native peoples had them for the girls too, but usually girls get it. You know, they menstruate once every 28 days. They get it. You know, I'm no longer a kid. I'm a woman. Every 28 days, as long throughout their reproductive cycle, they have that message from Mother Nature. Pretty undeniable message. We, as men, what do we get from Mother Nature in terms of that kind of message? We don't get it. And unless we happen to be, you know, the child of an immature father, which I was not. My father never became a man either. Unless we have the fantastic luck of having a mature father, the sons do not get it either. And we live in a world of arrested adolescence. That's the name of the game, arrested adolescence. It's all over. look for it on the internet. Not the term arrested, just look in the news. You know, we got kids shooting kids in school now. Yeah, that's kind of a daily thing now. Oh, what's the latest tragedy? How many kids were killed? It's amazing. So we have two taboos in our society, at least two, maybe more, and they are sex and death. And as I said, I was born in the late 30s, and those days, of course, I was a kid, but at that time, sex was a really big taboo, very much more taboo than it is today. It's not as taboo, certainly not as taboo as it was back then, but still taboo. And but the big biggie, the big black biggie is death. And boy, is that a taboo. And I'm shocked to see so many people here today. Maybe you didn't know what to talk to me, what the topic was going to be, you know, but you're very brave to show up. And I prepared photocopies because I don't want to just sit here and talk and then we say, oh, that was nice and that's it. I'd like to have you to have something to take home with you. And so the first, I'd like to start at a kind of unusual place, maybe. Which book is it from? Oh, yeah, this book. Preparing to Die. A pretty blunt title. I like it. And this is by a man, Andrew Holek, if I'm saying his name right. Practical Advice and Spiritual Wisdom from the Tibetan Buddhist Tradition. Very good book, except it's over 400 pages long. I haven't finished it yet, so I can't die, I guess. But it's a really excellent book, and I highly recommend. You don't have to be necessarily be a student of Tibetan. I'm not a student of Tibetan Buddhism. I never will be. It's too complicated. But I certainly have learned a lot from it. And so in this book, he has final suggestions for assisting someone who is near death. And probably if you haven't had that opportunity yet, you will later on. I worked for quite a while as a nurse, and so I was from time to time around dying people. And at that time, I was still pretty stupid. I'm still pretty stupid today, but not quite as stupid as I was then. And so often I was like, you know, this person's dying. What am I supposed to do, you know? So you might be in the same situation in the future. And in any case, if we prepare ourselves for assisting a person who is near death, that means we're preparing ourselves, actually. It all comes home. So please take one of these. Maybe we could split them up and then they'll get around faster. Thank you. Thank you. Oh. I didn't expect a large turnout, so there may not be one for everybody, but maybe there is. I don't remember how many I made, but somebody might have to share. Okay. So final suggestion for assisting someone who is near death. Number one, create a peaceful space. Number two, embrace all that may arise with love and or compassion. Number three, give the dying person something authentic to look forward to. Number four, let them go into the divine mystery. Everyone enters at death. So I'd like to go back over these one by one. Starting with number one, create a peaceful space. And then we could ask ourselves, how do we do that? Well, we just did it. Just here before we, you know, sat down here and I started talking. And we do it every Sunday. We create a peaceful space here in the Zendo. And, of course, it's not necessary to be here. And this is kind of a special place, but it's not necessary to be here. We can create a peaceful space to the degree we have peace in ourselves. If we don't have a lot of peace in ourselves, then creating a peaceful space is going to be probably a little difficult, particularly if somebody's dying. So it's important, then, to find out how we create peace in ourselves. And one of the reasons that's important is then we can offer it to others when they need it. And number two, embrace all that may arise with love or compassion. Well, that's the same thing again. If we have or have cultivated love or compassion in our life, then we have the capacity to embrace, you know, even difficult things with love and compassion. If we haven't taken the time and trouble to develop those things or cultivate those things, it might be difficult. Number three is interesting. Give the dying person something authentic to look forward to. Something authentic. Wow. What? You know, somebody's dying right here. What are we going to give them authentic to look forward to? Well, we could turn that, bring it back home. What do I, Greg, what do I have authentic that I would like to offer a person who is dying? It might be hard to find that initially, because that's a question we don't ask ourselves very often. But if I, for example, have something authentic that I'm looking forward to in terms of my death, then there we go. I've got something I can offer somebody else. Then the last one, which is something that sounds simple, but it's not, and we could reduce it, the number four, to three words: let them go. No clinging. That's sort of like a divine commandment number one in Buddhism, no clinging. And it's a toughie, particularly like if, you know, it's our mother, our father, you know, our husband, our wife, our child. But I found it's very, very useful to remember, okay, this person is dying, guess what? I'm going to die too. Everybody we see is going to die someday. More than 7 billion people alive in the world today, and they're all, every last one of them, is going to die sooner or later. And who knows how many billion people have already died, you know, when you can consider the beginning of humanity, which is how many thousands of years ago. Everybody sort of came out of the same mystery, you know. We didn't have an appearance before we were born. And then we go back into that mystery of invisibility. And it's hard to let somebody who we feel close to go, but it helps to remember that I'm going to go there too. And I don't have any choice about it. Nobody does. Okay. So, now I'd like, how much time do we have?
15 minutes.
Oh, God. some of these papers I'm just going to give you, and you're going to take them home, and we're not going to have a chance to talk about them. But that's the way life is. So, this is not, where is that other book? Oh, it doesn't matter. Preparing for Death. Preparing to Die. This is not out of that book. This is out of this book. This, what I'm going to give you now, is out of this book, which is by the Dalai Lama. And it's called Mind of Clear Light. And this is a dinky little book. It's got a really bizarre picture of the Dalai Lama on the cover. I think it's bizarre. Usually his picture is, he looks like a saint. And this one, he looks sort of like, well, what mischief are we going to do today? But I like it. And the book is absolutely, you know, incredible. This should be outlawed, this book. It is fantastic. And these are direct quotations, except for the title here, are direct quotations from this book, which I hope you will all find, which you'll all find useful sooner or later. So here we'll try and divide them up equally. Okay, some simple suggestions concerning preparing for death for all those who shall someday die. That includes pretty much everybody, I think. And this is quoted from Mind of Clear Light by the Dalai Lama. So, the motive for your practice should be the benefit of all living beings, their freedom from suffering, and attainment of perfection. Always adjust your motivation toward helping others as much as you can. at least try to do no harm. Buddhas are teachers of the spiritual path. They do not give realization like a gift. You have to practice morality, concentrated meditation, and wisdom on a daily basis. So that's pretty tough stuff. The Dalai Lama is not mincing words here. I like this first sentence, particularly the motive for your practice should be the benefit of all living beings. That's sort of like, you know, lesson, the first lesson in Buddhism, in Mahayana Buddhism anyway. And their freedom from suffering, that's part of it. And then attainment of perfection. See, that's really hit me because I hadn't really seen that in this particular combination. But then I thought, well, if I was completely free from suffering, that would be pretty close to the attainment of perfection. That seems to me. You know, if I don't have any suffering, then, you know, wow. And but just the possibility, just that possibility is fascinating. I think this first sentence is really one of the best teachings I've ever read in Buddhism. And then it goes on, always adjust your motivation toward helping others as much as you can. And then the next sentence, I at least try to do no harm. You know? Boy, boy. At least try to do no harm. Yeah. And then Buddhists are teachers of the spiritual path. They do not give realization like a Christmas gift. You have to practice morality, concentrated meditation, and wisdom on a daily basis. Boy. Okay, then we go on. Since this precious human life can be used in powerfully beneficial or destructive ways and is itself most fragile, make good use of it now. Physical happiness is just an occasional balance of elements in the body, not a deep harmony. Understand the temporary for what it is. Realize that the root of your own happiness and welfare rests with a peaceful and tamed mind. It is also a great benefit to those around you. So the closer we get to enlightenment, the more positive influence we can have on others, obviously. And this sentence, understand the temporary for what it is. In our culture particularly, we have a tendency to pick and choose the positive stuff, you know, and hang on to that as though it were permanent. But, you know, even the best movie comes to an end. Even the best television show is over at some point. And then comes what comes. Okay. Do you have the next page? You don't have the next page, do you? Or is it? You have
there's a back side to it.
Oh, back up on the back side. Yeah. Okay. You can just turn yours over. If you cultivate a sense of the uncertainty of the time of your death, you will make better use of your time. That's kind of obvious. Realize that no matter how wonderful the situation may be, its nature is such that it must end. Do not think that there will be time later. Be frank about facing your own death. Skillfully encourage others to be frank about their deaths. This is what we're doing. This is a remarkable meeting. I hope all of you appreciate how remarkable this is. How often do people get together like this to talk about death? What, in my case, maybe, what, the third time in my life, fourth time? It's just not done. It's a taboo. We're breaking a huge social taboo. I hope nobody hears about this. We might get in trouble. But yes, if you cultivate a sense of the uncertainty of the time of your death, you'll make better use of your time. And let me tell you, as an old guy in his late 70s, this really comes, it's home, you know. Because, you know, I have the typical chronic diseases that old people in our society have, from eating crappy food and not living in a healthy way. And so I'm paying the price now. I have high blood pressure. I have to take medicine every day, twice a day, actually. I have a heart that skips a beat every now and then. That's pretty interesting when I'm taking my pulse and it skips a beat. And I have a number of other chronic diseases, which I'd rather not go into with you. Okay, understand this body, which you sustain at any cost, will someday desert you. Avoid lusting after the situation you are leaving. Avoid hating that you have to leave. Realize that by taking a pill or an injection to have a so-called peaceful death, you may be depriving yourself of a crucial opportunity. You know, maybe we're meant to stay here, you know, until we go, not assist, you know, assist the process. But on the other hand, I think that's an individual decision. It is helpful to know that at some point all hope for continuing life will end. That's really tragic in a hospital when the doctor has to tell the patient that, you know, done it, we've done as much as we can, and there's nothing more we can do for you. At that point, it will be up to you to do what helps. You know, we can be helped by doctors and medicine a lot. Really, it's remarkable how much we can. But at some point, it becomes up to us to do what helps us in our last days. While dying, you need to remember spiritual instructions that accord with your own level of practice and enact them. I love this sentence. While dying, you need to remember spiritual instructions that accord with your own level of practice and enact them. Be determined to maintain this spiritual direction in all situations, no matter how difficult, such as on your deathbed. And then I think the next page, to avoid being depressed, is the first line on that page, I think.
I don't
have
that one.
What? I don't have that one. Do you have it? Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought they'd all gone out, but they hadn't.
There we go.
So maybe we're going to make it by 12:30. We'll see. Didn't quite make it, huh? Okay, I can make a copy if anybody didn't get a copy and they want one. To avoid being depressed about dying, take refuge in your respective religion within compassion for all beings. Reflect on the importance of extracting the essence of this present life. I like that. Extracting the essence of this present life. With that groundwork for effectively remembering your practice while dying, this is a really important sentence. With that groundwork for effectively remembering your practice while dying, even horrific events and appearances that might occur in the after-death state will only serve to urge you to be calm and to meditate with joy and confidence. I read where Rinpoche was once asked by a Western Tibetan student, student of Tibetan Buddhism, asked the Rinpoche, is there any simple way that we Westerners could prepare for the bardo? The bardo is the intermediate state between death and rebirth, if you're going to take a rebirth. Some people get out, but between death and rebirth is the bardo, what the Tibetans call the bardo. And preparing, and the bardo can be very freaky. Very, very freaky. And so they asked the Sripoche, you know, can we Westerners prepare in some way? And he said, well, he said, you could go and see as many horror movies as you can. I don't like horror movies. I've only seen one, and that was enough. And he said, you can go and see as many horror movies as you can. Oh, okay. And so even horrific events and appearances that might occur will only serve to urge you to be calm and to meditate with joy and confidence. Realizing that the myriad appearances, some even frightening and horrible, here we go again, which might occur while dying are due to karma. Okay, it's karma burning off. You know, we can burn karma now, or we can burn it later, but it gets burnt sooner or later. And then it says, do not be distracted by them. Although at some point the outer breath through the nose ceases, and there is no conscious reaction to external stimuli, the person has not died. It is helpful if the body is not disturbed until full death occurs. That's why the Tibetans recommend 3 days at least of leaving the body of somebody who's just died alone as much as possible, and to give full death. I mean, it takes, the breathing stops pretty quick in the death process, you know, and we take it to be death, but the awareness, leaving the body, that takes time. It's in, down in there with the DNA. It takes time to get out. Um, then down here, the final phase in the process of dying occurs when the fundamental innate mind of clear light dawns, and that doesn't dawn immediately, apparently. This mind has existed continuously since beginningless time and will continue to exist forever. This is a really important sentence here. This mind, the mind of clear light, has existed continuously since beginningless time and will continue to exist forever. And this is what we, in our culture and society, do not learn ordinarily to recognize. We take this meaty thing, this meaty meat and bone thing, to be it. You know, Greg is his meat and his bones. And when his meat and his bones die, Greg is dead. Well, the body dies, most certainly, you know. But the energy that is allowing me to talk and allowing me to see and allowing me to hear, the energy of awareness is eternal. And that energy is our life energy, and everybody's got it. If you're here, you've got it. The life energy is yours. You couldn't be here otherwise. And when the life energy leaves, then we leave with it. What?
About the Buddha saying that there's nothing eternal, there's nothing.
I forgot my hearing.
What about the Buddha saying there's nothing that lasts forever, there's nothing permanent?
Yeah, I don't know how that.
Even this idea of.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of statements in the teachings which appear to be contradictory, and I don't know how to resolve those contradictions. But I am absolutely convinced that the awareness, bare awareness or witnessing awareness, that's another term I like a lot, witnessing awareness. Like there is this witness in me and in you and in all human beings, I dare say, this witness that is witnessing everything without exception. And Buddhism stresses that basically this is a dream that we're dreaming together. I mean, when we're awake like this. We are all dreaming. We don't recognize this as a dream, and we don't necessarily cooperate in dreaming together consciously. But we're all dreaming together, and then at night we have another form of dream, which we are apparently creating ourselves because we're asleep. Although other beings and creatures can enter into our dreams at night, of course, but nevertheless. We have dreams at night, and then we have moments of dreamless sleep. And I'm convinced, on the basis of what I've been able to investigate in my own process and my own attention, that there is this witnessing awareness that is just always there, always witnessing, always the background. And the background is what is available to us to fall into, so to speak, when we die. And we fall into it at night all the time. You know, it's quite pleasant, actually. I particularly enjoy my dreamless sleep. It's really the best. Eventually, at Buddhahood, you become capable of remaining in the innate mind of clear light without passing through the reverse process of the coarser levels of consciousness. Okay, then the last page of quotations I have here is the ordinary mind of clear light that manifests in the final stage of death is called the mother clear light. I love it. And the clear light generated through the force of cultivating the spiritual path is called the child clear light. When the mother clear light of death, which dawns due to karma, turns into a spiritual consciousness knowing emptiness, or the child clear light, then this transformation is called the meeting of the mother and the child clear lights. I think it was, what was that singer's name? The mother and child reunion. Anybody remember that? From the 70s? That was a great song. The mother and child reunion. I wonder, what was his name? I can't think of it at the moment.
I can sing it, but I can't remember his name.
What's that?
I said I can remember the song, but I can't remember his name.
Yeah, right. I wonder if somehow that has any relationship to this, you know, the mother and child reunion. I'm very big on the mother, so. Then the last quotation here. Oh, we're going to make it. In the tantric practice of deity yoga, and by the way, as far as I know, you don't have to be a Tibetan student of Tibetan Buddhism to practice deity yoga. But anyway, in the tantric practice of deity yoga, imagination, we all use our imagination anyway, imagination is used to accelerate spiritual development. This practice requires you, one, to imagine that your mind, even though ordinarily bothered by afflictive emotions, is a mind of pure wisdom motivated by compassion. And number two, to substitute the appearance of your ordinary body, composed of flesh, blood, and bone, with a body risen out of compassionately motivated wisdom. And number three, to develop a sense of pure self based upon a purely appearing mind and body in an ideal environment, fully involved in helping others. Imagination is the key. Of course, this goes on and on, but that was the stuff that impressed me the most of this particular book right here. However, there's another book of Tibetan Buddhism that I find really, really impressive, and that's this one. This is absolutely a Bible. It really ranks as a Bible. Probably most of you know it, but if you haven't come across this book, I really highly recommend it, although it, too, is over 400 pages long. Tibetans have a lot to say. I wish we had more time. Probably most of you have never heard of Ernest Becker. Anybody heard of Ernest Becker? No? Okay. Well, there's his picture anyway. He's dead now. And unfortunately, he died at 50. He only lived 50 years. It's really a tragedy. And he wrote several books, fortunately, before he died. He was a university professor. He taught it over across the bay at UC, UC Cal over there. And he was so radical, not in politically radical, but, you know, radical in his teaching, that he got fired by the administration, of course. The students got, this is back in the 60s, the students liked him so much, they got together and said, hey, we'll donate and pay his salary. We just want him to stay. And the administration, of course, said, no, you can't stay here if you're not on the faculty. You know, it doesn't matter if they're going to pay for your salary. You're out. So he went to Canada, like I did. Vancouver, like I did. And I was even there during the time he was dying, although I was really dumb in those days. Even dumber than I am now. And so I never heard of him until much later. And he wrote a book called The Denial of Death. And his thesis, and I'm not doing it justice, but he said that the primal fear of human beings is death. That sounds reasonable. And that all human, this is where his theory gets a little hard for a lot of people to swallow. All human activity is a reaction to their fear of death. So look at the pyramids in Egypt. Well, the Egyptians had big, big reactions to death, didn't they? And look at our graveyards. We have big reactions to death, too, you know? Of course, we've stopped building pyramids pretty much, but if you examine societies, you know, death is a big deal. And it should be, but it's surrounded with such superstition and misunderstanding, it's almost worthless. So in response, he didn't come up with this term. I like it very much. I think there's a whole group of people now who are sort of his disciples. Most of them are up in Seattle, I think. And they coined the term morbidity anxiety, that the chief psychological disease of human beings is morbidity anxiety. We are all anxious about our death, although we rarely ever talk about this, do we? And I'd so much like to go into him, but can't do it. And then, but there's a couple more things I just had to want to show you real quick. A couple more books. This is Carol Zaleski. She, I think, is a professor, assistant professor at Smith College. I mean, if this is a pretty old book, she may have retired by now or maybe not even be among us. But anyway, this is called Otherworld Journeys, Accounts of Near-Death Experience in Medieval and Modern Times. And near-death became a hot topic for me when I was living in Canada and I died.